Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey guys, welcome back to Soul Sisters. I'm coming to you from a very snowed in New York City. Have a nice little episode for you today to keep you warm if you are in our part of the world. And if you're not, it's a great one anyway. It's with Sarah Elizabeth Charles, who happens to be a good friend and former classmate of my dear co-host Dara's, and is actually, she's been documented in this documentary that Dara's been filming for the past 10 years, which you may have heard us talk about from time to time on this podcast. And now we got to talk to one of the actual featured members of the movie. So yeah, she's an amazing artist. She also does a lot of really important social justice work and work that intersects between those two things. She brings her art to people that really need it. And it was a lovely person. I was just meeting her for the first time. Obviously, she and Dara had a lot of history to go back through. So this was a really personal and inspiring episode, and I hope you guys enjoy it. Just a reminder, if you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Soul Sisters on iTunes. You can also watch this episode on YouTube, on Facebook's YouTube channel, if you prefer to see us that way. And make sure to follow Soul Sisters on Instagram at Soul Sisters Podcast to see ridiculous pictures of us hanging out with all these amazing people. Okay, that's it. All the plugs for the day. Now let's get to today's episode with Sarah Elizabeth Charles on Soul Sisters.
Sarah Elizabeth Charles, what a delight, a treat to have you here.
A delight, a treat, a wonder,
it's
a thrill.
Wonder. It's incredible to have you here on Soul Sisters and to meet Jesse and to connect these two worlds of music and this decade-long journey that I've been on exploring musicianship. And you are just the ultimate musician and soul friend, soul sister. So this is, thank you for being here.
That's so sweet. Thank you for having me.
You've inspired
me. What a nice introduction.
Yeah. You have inspired me since class. We had class together. And I was in total admiration over you, not only as a person, because you were always so kind to me. And I was a total weirdo in school, always with the camera. And some people reacted differently. You were always so generous and kind. But your musicianship was so on this level that I just marvel at, and your ability to be inside the music in ways that I could never even aspire to. So I was always totally in awe of you, and now even more so as the years go on. So anyway, let's start here. You were gonna say we met in school.
Yeah, well, we met in school, and I distinctly remember becoming friends before seeing you with a camera ever. So I remember being in class together.
That's good.
That is good.
I found people, which is in the footage, met you when you were holding a camera.
So happy to hear.
Oh, nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, that is true.
Yeah.
Who was that? You and Ross?
A million people.
Yeah, there's someone I remember that's in the movie. Yeah. Anyway.
Got it. So it's fascinating to me and slightly terrifying because I think Dara has footage of so many of us, which once we actually see the final product, I think some of us are going to watch and slightly cringe, as you do when you see yourself on film or you listen to yourself like talking or anything.
Or any proof of what you looked like or sounded like when you were in college.
Yes.
Because horrifying.
We were all like
not good years aesthetically.
Absolutely.
Was gorgeous, flawless.
No, that is not.
I'm projecting. I'm projecting.
Yeah. There are going to be moments of cringing, I think, but more important than that, there's like sort of, it's going to be so cool because there's this documentation of that time.
Totally.
So we all have like memories of that time, and memories are great, but one of like the positive things about technology. I have a very interesting relationship yep. to technology, uh-huh. and it's ever like it's very fluid, and I have different feelings about it at different times. But this particular like mm-hmm. element, like being able to actually film and capture something on film that lives in your mind and then eventually see it back, is mm-hmm. I think going to be just really special and really yeah. cool, because we've all done so much and changed as people, and like our sounds have changed and our spirits have changed and our energies have changed, but we're going to be able to like Dara's been able to like freeze this like these moments in time for us. Yeah. So I'm super excited to see it.
Do you feel like the artist that you are today is vastly different from what you imagined when she started filming you?
Yeah, I think when Dara started filming, I still wanted to be Sarah Vaughan. I still wanted to like sing yeah. straight ahead jazz.
Uh-huh.
And I still wanted to like, I imagined that for myself. Cause that was my freshman year of college, yep. freshman, mm-hmm. sophomore year. So I still had a very clear image of wanting to be that. And I'm very much not that. And
right.
I chose shortly thereafter not to be that.
Yeah.
But it was before I started really digging into my songwriting and my original yeah. music.
Yeah.
Yeah. One place I have a lot of stuff of us from is a class with Janet Lawson, vocal rhythm section with incredible jazz singer Janet Lawson.
Whoa, what's the laugh?
I want to hear what that laugh is, but I'll just describe. She is a very unique, amazing spirit, and she is known as like, you know, one of the pioneers of like scat singing. Mm-hmm. Was nominated for a Grammy in 1982 opposite Ella Fitzgerald, who yeah. beat her
Whoa.
For a Grammy wow. for a jazz performance album. So that's to give you a context of how kind of our education was in this way of like scat singing and real vocal jazz, the true tradition of it. And it was so beyond me. And that's the thing, you got it. Even though you don't want to be that kind of singer now, it's in your bones and you understood that then. So I'm curious about that laugh. I'm curious about how you think now about just the institution of jazz school being such a natural musician and hearing that and not being a struggle for you. But what did you gain from being in school?
Yeah, I think so just to explain the laugh, I just feel so far away from anything mm. that or from what I'm doing right now. Mm-hmm. Far away and close at the same time though, because mm. it's a part of like that foundational like establishment, I think, for all of us. Like, and we were all inspired by it in different ways and then chose to move into the future in different ways in relationship to it, to that tradition, specifically like jazz vocal singing as you think of it traditionally when you think of someone like Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan or Billie Holiday mm-hmm. or the many others. And Janet is brilliant and taught us so much and always like also encouraged us to do our own thing. Like I studied privately with her for a while and she was always like, keep songwriting, like yeah. let's work on these like 12 solos, but then let me hear what you're working on, like what you're writing. And so there was always sort of this like dichotomy relationship between like the tradition and making sure that it was rooted, that my education was like rooted in that, and then also encouraging me to bring that into the future. So I think that what's interesting is like about what you mentioned in your perception. I think we all have like perceptions of like other people's experience, and like say, like when you say, it just makes me laugh too when you say like, oh well, you just had such a handle on it, and you just had, I didn't feel like that. I felt like I was like my head was just above water or that I was drowning a lot of that time, and I think we all feel that way, and we all have things that like, you know, somebody else might think, or we might be really good at putting a face on, like, oh, this is easy for me, this is like no big deal, and then inside we're like freaking out yeah. because it's very much not. So that's that reaction as well.
Yeah.
That's where that was coming from.
So yeah. So what do you take away, I guess, in the technical side of having gone to jazz school as opposed to just going at it on your own? You know.
Yeah, I think that you can't like build a house without a really strong foundation. And depending on what kind of career you want to have and what genre of music you go into, I feel like regardless, even if you're creating something that's sort of like new and that exists as sort of like a marriage of different genres, which is kind of my direction and where I've been going, it's got to be grounded in something. Otherwise, the house is going to like topple over. Mm-hmm. I truly believe that. And if you want your career to be something long lasting, which I mean, I want to sing when I'm like 95 and wrinkly. I still want to be singing and maybe in different spaces. I don't want to be touring then maybe, but I want to be like able to like use my voice and to have enough like creative juices flowing within me and inspiration like that they're built upon, that I can do that, and I still have something to say. And so that's, I think, like what jazz was for me. I played classical piano when I was little, but I was never very good. And I always played by ear, and I discovered jazz when I was like 11. So after discovering jazz, it was like, oh, okay, this is going to be my ground. Mm-hmm. Like, this is going to be my foundation.
What did you discover exactly?
I discovered that unlike classical music, where like you very much have to read what's on the page, uh-huh. and it's about interpretation, but only to a certain extent, jazz was like all about interpretation.
Right.
It was all about freedom and was built on like a foundation. One of the prime elements to the foundation is improvisation, uh-huh. and just making stuff up.
Did a teacher introduce you to jazz? Or
yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I had a vocal teacher when I was 10, 11. My mom finally let me take private voice lessons, and she was a jazz singer. And I bought one of her albums, and it was all standards. And I learned like the entire album verbatim, every breath, every nuance. And I surprised her in class. I'm such a type A Capricorn. And I put the CD on, and I was like, I'm going to sing along to it. And she's going to like know that like I really appreciate her, yeah. and I'm going to get an A. It wasn't a graded class. You know, it was like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I did it, and she was like, and she saw something, I don't know what, and she said, oh, well, you know, I'm going to bring you, I've told the story so many times, I'm going to bring you upstairs to the jazz ensemble, and you can just, like, sit in with them. And it was this scholarship jazz ensemble at the community music school in my hometown of Springfield, Massachusetts, and I sat in, and I sang They Can't Take That Away From Me and Don't Get Around Much Anymore, exactly like she sang it, Montina Scheider, that's her name, exactly like Montina Scheider sang it. And afterward, the leader of the ensemble, who was this, I call him a bear of a bass player. He was a teddy bear, and then he was also like a really scary, like grizzly bear. He uh-huh. was like very old school teacher mm-hmm. That like taught you like you were on the bandstand all mm-hmm. the time. It was really intense. He said, okay, I guess you're in. And it was my audition. And I didn't realize that until after the fact. And then I proceeded to like spend a whole year of going there every single Thursday, I think it was, where that's when our classes were. And I would leave crying, and my mom would make me go back.
You were 11?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And
why would you leave crying?
Because he pushed us. You know, I think he asked me, or like after a couple classes, he said, do you want to be a singer? Or do you want to be a musician? Mm-hmm. And I was like, what's the right answer? You know? Yeah. And I was like, I guess a musician. That sounded, you know, like an obvious, yeah. you know, he kind of, it was a leading question, uh-huh. Vishnu. But it was so strange. And now I kind of understand like where he was coming from yeah. in that regard, especially like having students of my own and uh-huh. figuring out like what their goals are. So just for myself, it was just a really, for me, it was a really helpful time in like steering me in the direction that like has brought me to where I am now.
Yeah.
And helped me. And I think I'm grateful for it too, because speaking of like jazz school,
right.
you know, jazz school used to just be the bandstand, like any, you know, anything.
Right.
The conservatory, the idea of conservatory and jazz is really new even still. So I'm grateful to be the age that I am and have had the opportunity to learn on the bandstand, because he would hire mm-hmm. us like in his band, and we would tour in like the New England area and do like little things, and it was cool and it was helpful, because we would just like get our butts kicked, and it was that was helpful to learn in that way, in addition to being able to go to conservatory.
And do you still see the value of a conservatory? And I mean, especially as a teacher now, and is there a lot that you would say that you took from the later years of studying, like
yeah.
in jazz school?
I think so. I think being in New York and being in school was really awesome, because you could kind of like be in New York, but not really, you didn't have to really worry about the hustle. I mean, you had to worry about how to pay for school, but you didn't really have to worry about like gigging, or you could kind of just like be a fly on the wall and like learn about the scene before mm-hmm. having to like insert yourself in it. So I'm so glad I decided to come to New York for school. Some of the professors at the new school, many of the professors were just like awesome. And I was like, more, and I would always ask for like more, which was really great. I think that the institution in and of itself is still like figuring out what it is in relationship to like what the music's becoming, because it's really important to be grounded in the foundation, but ideally like that happens before you enter college, or that happens like the first couple of years, and mm-hmm. then the question is like, what do you do the next 2 years to actually give people the space and the information and the tools that they can then build a career on?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, still the missing component in just conservatories as a whole.
Yeah.
You learn so much about music, but you don't learn how to like as much. You don't learn as much how to actually make a business out of it.
Right. Yeah.
I learned that outside of school. I learned that. I took a business class in school, but it's not, I don't think enough emphasis is placed on that. So.
Yeah. I was on the subway last week sitting next to two women who sounded like they went to music school together and were both now further along in their careers. And one of them was on her way to teach like an intro class. I think it was at NYU or one of those schools. It wasn't New School because I would remember that. But anyway, it was a business class. And so they had both like taken this class before and now she was going to go teach it. So they were talking about the experience they had with it as students versus how she was going to approach it as a teacher.
Yeah.
And they were complaining that like one of the teachers that one of them had said like, you need to like go out and network with like your resume and a business card. Mm-hmm. And the one who was about to teach the class was like, I'm going to make all the students do a Kickstarter campaign. They don't have to launch it, but they need to set it up, you know, and that it's all about like I'm going to ask them every week, like, who have you met? Who have you talked to? Not to hand out a business card, but like, who have you played with? Yeah. Just like being out there.
And that's all important.
Right.
I mean, mentorship is so huge in jazz,
period,
and also huge in jazz school, which is one big way that I think it is different from other institutional learning because there is this boundary, lack of boundary almost between teacher and student because it is trying to translate that bandstand situation, which is very informal, nightclub-esque, and then into the classroom. And I think this is where it can become very murky with boundaries, and especially if we talk about gender, and you know the difference between someone like Janet Lawson as a mentor and maybe this bear of a bass player who it sounds like had the best of intentions and had his own way of encouraging you, but that can be tricky. And so this kind of leads into I ran into Melanie Charles, who is another dear friend from school, a fabulous vocalist, and I saw her at Smalls recently, and she was like, guess what? They're going to have a gender and jazz class at the new school. And she, I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. I can't believe it. And she was like, guess who's going to teach it? I was like, yeah. She's like, Sarah Charles. Is this true?
Yes.
Okay, this is amazing.
Wow, there we go.
The reason that she was telling me this is because when we were at the new school, I don't know if you remember this, Melanie and another friend, Raquel, had sort of initiated gender and jazz workshops, just very kind of informal, you know, a couple times a year. You know, we had to offer like cupcakes and like hope that 10 people would show up to these talks. We had, you know, guest speakers and I was sort of documenting it. So that's why she shared that with me. But I was like, that's amazing. And so I'm really curious. And gender and jazz is sort of more as gender is more is on our minds as throughout the world, but in jazz as well. I was just at the gender and jazz panel for Jazz Fest, where Esperanza Spalding and Angela Davis and Arnetta Johnson and Vijay Iyer were all on a panel and they were discussing it and it was fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I'm super curious how you plan to put gender and jazz into a school classroom setting, create a curriculum and build an entire year around that. That's a daunting and amazing task at hand.
Yeah, it definitely is. Thanks for reminding me of that.
It's happening. So you're in the second semester?
No. This is a semester by semester.
Okay.
Class okay, offering yeah, so yeah. far. We'll see what it grows into. But this past Monday was the second class.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
We're in it. And at this point in time, it's more of a survey course because there are so many different ways to approach this. So it has sort of it has a historical element, a sociological element, a cultural element, and a personal element. Mm-hmm. Those are sort of the four areas that I'm touching on. And it's hard because the historical element, for instance, could be an entire semester. It could be a sociology course in which we're doing like qualitative and quantitative research for the entire semester, et cetera. It could be so many different things. But I thought that it would be really important to kind of like touch on all of these areas because as a school, the New School for Jazz and Contemporary Music, is their long-term plan is to make this like a larger thing.
Okay.
So this is, that's a little but it's really exciting because you know, sitting down with the dean and talking about like the formation of this class, it originally started as the idea was like, okay, well, we'll have like a women in jazz course, and that wasn't settling with me. I was like, there's something about this that doesn't feel right. That doesn't feel all-encompassing. That doesn't feel, because I, you know, at school I studied jazz vocal performance, but then I also studied sociology and urban studies. So I was like such a fan of, and I did my my final project. Your undergrad isn't called your dissertation or anything like that, but I did my final paper, like a 100-page paper or whatever, mini paper on the institutionalization of jazz music, and did a lot of like qualitative field research and quantitative research, and like used like Pierre Bourdieu, who's a sociologist who specialized in, he has this book called The Rules of Art, The Rules of Art, and it's about like the field, artistic fields and spaces, and how people relate to each other, and what's considered like high art and low art, and how judgments are cast on that, and all of that. So I'm just super fascinated by him, and think he's just brilliant, and so used like his whole philosophy to like study the New School for Jazz and Contemporary Music. But anyway, the more and more the dean and I spoke, the more I realized like, oh wait, what am I as the teacher or as the lead faculty, because I can't be there every week. I'm still touring and I'm still doing all of that. So the way that we've structured it is I'm there the most. I'm the lead faculty and like the person designing it, but I have guest lecturers coming in. I think for about 6 or 7 sessions of the 15 sessions this semester, which will be super exciting, and we're really getting to the crux of like, wait, why does this exist? Like, let's not, like, there's value for sure in coming together as like a group of women, for instance, or even just a group of men and women, or people who identify as being male or female, and like speaking about these issues and speaking about what we can do to shift things into the future. But my interest is more with this class in like zooming out and really getting to the crux of like, okay, well why? What role has gender played in relationship to this art form? And why are women and people who consider themselves to be homosexual, bisexual, why are these people existing still to this day as the minorities in this music? And what is this culture of masculinity that's been like cultivated and seemingly like nourished over the years? And why do we feel like we have to just survive in that? There's more, I think there's more to it. And if we zoom out and really get to the crux of like why, then we can start figuring out. And so it's a really, I'm not attempting to do that in
can
one
we
semester.
Take this class?
Wait, is it possible that there's footage of you guys talking about this kind of stuff at school?
I have gender and jazz class. I mean, it's not this, but why?
Like in your apartment?
I think so. I mean, in a very, in a much less sophisticated
way. But between
way.
The two of you?
Maybe not. I don't know if we've ever talked about it. Because, when you were doing, I remember what Melanie was leading, and or what you guys were put together while you guys were there. And I think I was like early, it was early on in my, I swear I can speak English. It was early on in my my time there. And I don't think I ever attended or ever.
I mean, that speaks to how far we've come. It wasn't something enticing or like appealing at the time. That just blew my mind. I mean, that sounds so amazing. How has the reaction been? How's the enrollment in that class?
It's great. It's capped at this point, which is amazing. And the population we've all spoken very candidly and openly. We had like an hour and a half discussion of the first class just about personal experience and like where we're all coming from, because I think like cultivating like a safe space in which people can speak is really crucial and huge, and just as important as like any historical context or information we might get, for instance. So we've really just been like talking and sharing and getting to know each other, and the diversity of identification and also just opinion in this space is like really exciting to me. I had no idea who was going to be sitting down when I went on the first day, and it's just, I think it's, I'm just really hopeful, because this, like, the people in the space are the future of like not just jazz music, but just music. Like, they're part of the future of music. They're there, they're studying, and who knows what they're going to go on to create after they leave. And so it's really, I feel like talking about it now is like really important. And then eventually, like, talking about it in high school, making it earlier and earlier. Because it's not just about, you know, I feel like so many of us are, have been a part of conversations in which like people have been victimized in certain ways or have had to survive through stuff, and it's like, okay, well, there's definitely value in coming together and feeling the camaraderie in that regard, but like, how do we get to it before it becomes that? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I don't presume to like to know what
but
the answer is.
But you're working to investigate that. Yeah. And I think that's what we need more of. I mean, that's so fantastic to hear that you're doing that. And this, I want to talk about your musicality and your new project, but your teaching is so wide ranging now. Because this is a real professorship at school, and this is not the only thing you teach. So you tell us about the different things that you do, because this, let's talk about the Sing Sing facility work that you do. What is that? How have you come to that, and how has that impacted you?
Yeah, and actually this is super related to the new music and to what I'm putting out. Like, it used to exist, my teaching and my performing artist life used to exist as like two just like parallel roads. And now they've just like gotten closer and closer, and it was like, oh, should I keep them separate? And then they just collided and merged without my say. So I feel like when you're a songwriter too, you're writing about what you're experiencing in your life. And my teaching artist or what you perceive or what you observe, and my teaching artist experience specifically with Carnegie Hall and also with an organization in Haiti called Rise to Shine. Those were like the inceptions of essentially my teaching life being merging with my performance life and my songwriting.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So I've been a teaching artist with Carnegie Hall for like 5 years now, for about 5 years. And I started as a part of a project called the Lullaby Project, where we get together with expectant mothers or fathers, or mothers and fathers of small children, and write original lullabies with them for their kids and for their families.
Oh my God.
And this has grown into, like, with Carnegie Hall, I'm not as involved with the Lullaby Project now, but it's grown into like this nationwide initiative. And there are like satellite programs all over the country. They've also done it a bit internationally, and we'll plan to do it more. But there are like tens, maybe thousands. I'm going to say thousands because I'm not positive about the exact number of lullabies now, original lullabies that have been created with particular kids in mind or families in mind. And it's done in all different circumstances, because it's valid to all of us in some sort of way. We come from somewhere. And a lot of the population or participant population that that the project works with are in various forms of like just difficult situations. So they work with the Department of Homeless Services. I've done a couple workshops, songwriting workshops for the Lullaby Project at Rikers Island. Where else? They do projects at Beth Israel Hospital and various hospitals in the New York area. So it's a really amazing project, and I miss being a part of it, but there's only so much time, and I've become more involved in the Future Music Project, which is a songwriting project, and other elements of music, but I'm specifically involved in the songwriting class, and that includes teens from all over New York City. And they can actually physically come to Carnegie Hall now, because we have a whole wing devoted to educational outreach. So they come there once a week. Oh, it's
like thrilling.
I've said that to them so many times, and like, I feel like I just sound like the old lady. Yeah. If I could come to Carnegie Hall, if I could have done that when I was 15 or 14, you know.
Oh my God, I did a Juilliard like musical when I was in a high school or middle school or something.
And
I was just like, this
everything.
Is everything. Yeah. You know, this is, totally. I've made it. This is a dream.
Yeah.
Well,
and
so
the
cool.
level of talent in the space is just like, ooh, and it's just so cool to like see these young musicians come into the space and create just like amazing stuff, and to be able to kind of like have some sort of part in like in hopefully like guiding them along. But that's something. So that's one of the projects that I'm super involved in now. And then the project at Sing Sing Correctional Facility. Carnegie's been at Sing Sing for almost a decade now, or for about a decade. So this is like it was all happening and up and running many years before I got there. But I started by being a visiting artist in the space, and so I'd come in and sing. It's a songwriting project, and just like that's what it started as, songwriting and orchestration and arranging. And now it's sort of broadened the scope to be something that is like an all-inclusive musical workshop space, because Carnegie Hall just committed another ton of years to the project.
What does that look like? You go there and what?
So you we are there every other Saturday. There's another organization called Musicambia that's a partnership program with Carnegie Hall. And so they're there every Saturday that we're not there. So really it's music every Saturday. And at this point in time in the morning, I have a partner in crime, Matt Moran, who leads the morning workshops, and I lead the afternoon workshops. And so the morning workshops are much more like theoretically based and about arranging and just learning like theoretical concepts.
So you'll sit with the inmates and talk about musical concepts and theory and stuff.
Yeah, all of the musicians in the space are many of them were either musicians before going to prison, or they learned enough within the context of the program at this point that they could easily work on it as professional musicians or composers on the outside. So it's pretty. You know, the range of experience is pretty wide, but the musician participants in the space are just just as hungry as any of us. You know, you're working on music, so you go in and it's sort of while you're working and while you're collaborating with, like, because it's a whole musical community that we're included in, and so you forget where you are to a certain extent, and then you remember when you leave.
But
So Carnegie's been able to work with Sing Sing Correctional Facility. They have a really amazing staff that oversees the whole program and approves different things. So as long as we have to sort of submit lists, I'm not as involved in this part of it, thank goodness, because it's so detailed, but like people will request certain instruments or certain pieces of music, and they'll figure out how to get them inside. During each visit, we'll try to bring some things that people need. But at this point, we have keyboards, they have a drum set that we had nothing to do with the drum set or the couple of amps that they have. They had that before us, because it wasn't as if music didn't exist at Sing Sing before Carnegie was there either. It was very much there.
I just am so unaware. Is this a unique thing that Sing Sing has, or is this, you know, music programs come to correctional facilities more than I would imagine? Like, how unique is this?
I definitely don't think it's not common. I think that especially in a maximum security prison, it's really difficult. It can be really difficult to get the approval. And oftentimes, to be honest, you know, I think oftentimes people are really hesitant to the idea because they think for whatever reason that, you know, just people will oppose like a music program coming into a prison, just like they'll oppose the ability for anybody in a prison to be able to get like a GED or a college education, because they're seeing that time as being punishment for something. So why should those people be rewarded or given access? Right. And I've had that argument posed to me when I've told people what we're doing there. And you know, what I say in response to that, so it's not common. Sing Sing Correctional is very close to New York City, and there are a lot of resources, I think. But I've been to, there's another prison called Lee Correctional in North Carolina that I've been to a couple times with an organization called Dakota, which is also a Carnegie affiliate. And they were there just for a week a year. So that's much different than being there every Saturday. Yeah. You know, it's just a week and it's intensive. And they have their own music throughout the course of the year as well, but they don't have like personalized instruction or group instruction.
Right.
I was going to say that in response to the people who have sort of, you know, challenged what we're doing and said, you know, well, why do those people deserve that? You know, my response is, you know, we have a really, really big issue in this country. We are at this point, I think, first or second in terms of the percentage of our population incarcerated in the whole world. It's a real problem that we don't talk about because it's set aside. You know, the prison's in Ossining, New York. It's not in New York City. It's not in the center. Yeah. If it were in Central Park, people would be talking. But it's not. So it's sort of, there's that to think about, and the fact that there must be something that we're not quite doing right if that's, if given who we are on the world stage, mm-hmm. if we're first or second in terms of our percentage of population incarcerated. And also over 80%, I think it's like 85 or 90% of the population who is incarcerated will be coming home, because they're not, these aren't
life sentences. Yeah,
they're mm-hmm. not life without parole sentences. Right. That's a very small percentage of the people that we're talking about. And there are laws in place still as we're legalizing certain things, for instance, that people have already been sentenced because mm-hmm. of the three strikes rule, for instance, to more severe penalties than something like sexual assault. It's just really, there are just a lot of things that need to change and to shift. Mm-hmm. And there are already people who are in circumstances that they won't be able to get out of because of how laws have functioned in the past and how our prison system has functioned. I mentioned Rikers Island and the whole Close Rikers campaign that kind of seemingly came to an end in terms of media attention last year. That campaign at this point is still, the plan is to close within the next 10 years, which isn't good enough. And it's hard because the majority of women, for instance, that we interact with via the Lullaby Project are there without having been convicted of anything. They're there because they can't afford bail. That's the problem with Rikers, and that's why the campaign was able to get to be as successful as it was. It's not, it's a holding facility for people who are living in poverty.
Yeah.
And that's not okay. And so I don't mean to use this platform for that, but it's sort of, it's important to just like to talk about. And I think that's, the music side of things is great. And I feel so lucky that I get to, like, that I'm exposed to something that I wasn't exposed to growing up,
mm-hmm.
and that we get to talk about it in this type of setting because of the work that Carnegie's doing. So it's like really,
no, it's amazing. We often try to talk about issues like this with artists, but it's rarely as tangible as it is with you because of this work that you're doing.
I mean, what's so cool is that this music is simultaneously bringing you to these situations and giving you these experiences and allowing you to have opinions and want to make change, and also then you get to put that into music. That's actually the work that you do, is actually making music about that. And I imagine, or I don't know how you consider the idea of like, there's so much to do and my form is music, you know, like that's just such a weighty thing. So this segues into your album. Free of Form is such a rich, heavy, powerful, empowering, uplifting, gorgeous fantastic album. And you tackle this, mass incarceration, and lots of other issues that we're dealing with. And I just wonder, you know, what is the process for you? I mean, your previous album before this was Inner Dialogue, which, you know, I don't know much about, but was probably more about your inner life.
Yes.
You know, and so the change now for you, having all of these life experiences and also just the world changing so dramatically, just talk about the experience of writing this album.
I think that it's a direct reflection. Inner Dialogue was a direct reflection of like my internal space, you know. I recorded it in like, or I wrote the music in my early to mid 20s, recorded it, released it then. So it was definitely like, you know, I was a young woman coming into herself, a young artist, a young
human. Were you still
human.
Wanting to be Sarah Vaughan?
No. Okay. Oh, definitely not. That stopped like sophomore year of college.
Okay.
If not before that, like freshman year
And
of
what was the, what did you say? I don't want to be Sarah Vaughan, but I do want to be more like what?
I want to write my own music and carve out my own space. So I said in another interview recently that like, it's like you're in a room and there are no doors, right? Like, how do you carve out? Like, I say this to artists. I said it in an interview recently. Like, how do you carve out a me-sized hole? Whatever that me-sized hole is, to figure out how to get out of that room.
Yeah.
Because people are going to try to box you in, and people are going to try to identify you as particular things. Are you a jazz singer? Are you a soul singer? Do you sing trap music? Like, what are you doing? And it's like, well, no, actually, like, I do all of those things, and it's just me, and that's okay.
That.
You know, but people are comfortable with labels, and I get that. I'm one of them, depending on what we're talking about. I digress a little bit, but inner dialogue was sort of like that exploration and like putting that out there.
Yeah.
So Inner Dialogue was like, I still listen to it, and I'm like, I'm really proud of each of those moments. Albums are snapshots, you know, they're not continuous through time, but I listen to it and I'm like, wow, I was going through some stuff and I was really like laying it all out there. It's a really personal album in terms of like, okay, here's what I'm thinking about, guys. Like, here's everything.
I mean, that pretty much is what being in your 20s is like.
Right.
Like, I'm angsty and everyone should know about my angst. Right. Because it's epic.
Yeah. And it's valuable. Yeah. And all of that.
Which is not untrue.
It's not. Totally. Yeah. And there's value in course. I had so many conversations with people about, you know, about some of the subject matter, and like people would be like, oh, I have that curiosity too.
Yeah.
Like that curiosity.
It's very relatable.
Yeah. It's like really important to put it out there in music.
Yes.
Free of Form though was more like the inner dialogue was the reflection of the internal. Free of Form was the reflection or observations made of the external world. Because I found myself just in a space where I couldn't really look at anything else. It was like, oh my gosh, but this is happening and I'm experiencing this and I'm seeing this and I'm like reading about this and I'm, you know, and it also, given the political environment that, you know, that was happening and that still exists and that we're sort of dealing with in this country in particular and globally too, but specifically in this country at that time, when I started writing, it was sort of like, that's what was on my mind and my heart all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what was coming out. And I think, I don't know, the Free of Form title, I guess I'll talk, because I could go like song by song and tell you about it.
Right.
But I think it's more valuable to talk about the title in general, because I think that that sort of speaks volumes, and kind of it goes back to like the time when I did want to sound like Sarah Vaughan and then realizing that that wasn't what it was going to be. And also like the progression from Inner Dialogue to this next record and my choices made there and where my spirit was going and following that, and just sort of not boxing yourself into any sort of space or identity, because for all of us, that's like ever changing and fluid. And at the core, we are who we are, but like, just figuring out time and time again, like, okay, well, what is like the best form of that? And by best, I don't mean like the most happy or the you know, like being able to do things really well. I don't mean that. I mean like what's the most like authentic form of ourselves. And that's what that title is about. Because it's really cool when you think about, like, even if you're a twin or, you know, you are the only you.
Right.
And we have such a, like, we have a fragment of time on this planet. It's like, well, what the hell are we going to do with it? You know? And what are we going to say? And for me, that stopped being, like, telling my story.
Mm-hmm.
And that started to be, you know, I have this mic in front of me, whether I'm singing or sitting and talking with you all. And it's like, well, what the heck am I going to use that time to talk about or say or focus my attention on? And for Free of Form, that became really obvious. I was like, I'm going to talk about issues of race relation, and I'm going to talk about mass incarceration, and I'm going to talk about just the concept of freedom in general, and I'm going to speak to how I feel as, like, a woman not in her mid to early 20s anymore, like, coming into her own and feeling like I have this, like, newfound, like, strength that's really cool that I never felt like I had before, and all of that and more. Just really...
Yeah.
Just reflecting that in the music was something that felt, it was a choice, but it was more so just like a choice to follow a natural like pull.
And it happened lyrically, but also musically. There's a way that you're able to convey these ideas, not only in how you wrote your songs, but how you arranged them. And then to watch you perform them is so powerful because, and it comes across in the recorded version as well, but there's such an interplay with the musicians and such a, still an improvisational spirit to it. It is an improvisational.
Yeah.
And there's such a just exploration of sound that really conveys different things at different times. And I wonder how much you struggled with that, or if that was the easier part, or what kind of process that was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my band, my band is called Scope, formerly we were the S.E. Charles Quartet, very jazz. So we're called Scope, and we've been together for about 8 years now. So when I started rolling out this new music, it's so fun, like, getting together and being like, okay, guys, like, let's have coffee and, like, you know, get together, like, next Tuesday morning, and I'll have, you know, food, I'll get you breakfast sandwiches, whatever. And like, just saying like, okay, well, here you go. Like, here's a new song and here's a new song, and just playing through them. And I remember one of the first sessions, I can't remember whether it was, some members of my band are Jesse Elder, Bernice Earl Travis II, and John Davis on piano, bass, and drums. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of them saying, I think it was Burness. He was sitting with my cat and he was like petting him and we played Taller, which is a song about the sort of like that feminine energy that can be so powerful in all of us because we all have it. We all have it.
Women and men.
Women and men. Uh-huh. And he said, he's like, man, like, what took you so long? Like, we're really coming into some shit now. And I'm like, yes, yeah, we are.
That's the reaction you want. That's awesome.
And it was cool. And we were playing and we were really just like, we were all also coming because I have a community of about 10 musicians that I play with who I consider to be a part of Scope. Uh-huh. But they're the original band. Uh-huh. So it was really cool to like explore with that core band and then with other musicians and start to like shape what the music was going to be and play with sounds, and introduce like SPDS and like sub kick drum into the whole mix and kind of like get into some like allusion to like trap music a little bit in the music in addition to really being rooted and grounded in soul and jazz. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it was a really fun time of exploration and pushing boundaries and me saying like, I don't care anymore. And not, of course we care as artists how other people perceive, but that used to be something that I cared about and thought about so much.
Like, what will the community think or the fans or who? Uh-huh.
What will anybody that hears this think of me? What will my band think of me when I put this song in front of their faces? Because it lives inside my mind and I think it's like, it feels good to me, but who knows what it's going to feel like to anybody else. And I'm slowly realizing that has to be something that's there, but it has to be like an afterthought. You've got to just create, because you got to get all the crap out of there. There's a lot of bad stuff that's going to come out, like stuff that doesn't really deserve to be put in front of anybody or whatever, in order for the good stuff to start flowing. And again, I'm using judgments like good, bad, whatever. But, you know, stuff that is going to be more fruitful and that you're actually going to want to communicate to the world and to your audience.
Right.
Yeah. and I mean, huge success. Just so, I mean, we started off by talking about, you know, what will I do and what does an artist do when they have something that they feel proud of and they're talking about, and then the question comes like, well, what's next? And you know, you've become such a fully formed artist who cares about things and wants to put forth that, you know, important ideas within your music and grow in that way. Is that an added pressure now, thinking about your next step, or is it just, you know, it's there's no different. It's you're gonna continue on, be inspired by the things, and want to explore the things you want to explore. How do you feel about moving forward?
Yeah, I as a songwriter and a lyricist in particular, I've been really fascinated with poetry recently. And so I'm kind of like Mary Oliver, Maya Angelou was one of the first poets that I just loved. And not many people know, you know, she has, I think, 7 autobiographies. People know her as a novelist or as a writer in that sense, but not many people know her poetry. And starting to get out of my own word space, because so many people have said so many things in such beautiful ways. So I've been in different circumstances recently. It's weird how the universe works, like commissioned to write to poetry, not those particular poets, but more contemporary poets, even than Mary Oliver, although she's still working in publishing, and using their words to create sound and a sonic space. And that's been really cool. So I feel like my next project might be something like that, exclusively, like where the lyrics don't really come from me at all. It's just the sonic palette that's created that comes from like my creative energy space.
It's, awesome. It's very fun to watch you do the loops and the vocal effects and all the things. I mean, you create such soundscapes right in front of us and then record it. It's really exciting.
Yeah, it's fun. So who knows? I've also thought about doing a whole album, because I could do that in my apartment, which would be so fun. Like putting out an album or an EP. I've been using the Loop Station to write a lot as a writing tool in addition to just sitting at the piano. And that used to be my primary, and now the Loop is becoming much more a part of it, just to build those soundscapes and figure out, okay, let me sing what I want the bass to play, or let me kind of try to beatbox what I want the drums to play, or whatever. And I would never do those things live, but thinking about, okay, how could I compose something that would just be exclusively that? And in the studio, you can do so much more too, right? Because you don't need a looper.
Right.
You can just like go back in and you can create it live as well. I did record my album with my TC Helicon voice live pedal, by the way.
All right.
And we weren't going to use it. And we weren't going to use it for the final. We got like a clean sound line, and then we got that sound because for performance purposes, it was really important for me to be able to control like my own delay, my own harmonizer, all that. And it was so cool because we were able, the engineer at Bunker Studio, John Davis, his name is also John Davis, not the drummer, but the engineer and the bassist, he was like so brilliant. And we were able to take that line and use it for the entire album. So the post-production was like done because all the effects were already there. So I guess I could record that album if he were the engineer. But yeah, anyway, yeah, we'll see. But I have like, I have so much music. This is the first time where I have like an excess amount of music.
Oh, that's great.
So like we could record, or I could record like next week, but that's not going to happen yet. But so record, going back into the studio and recording something of my own, and then a couple other projects. I have a duo project with Jarrett Turner called Tone. We're going to be recording this year, recording the next album with Ajoyo. We'll be doing that this year. So yeah, just,
and then all of the other stuff, the teaching, the traveling,
changing the world.
It's all good stuff. I don't presume to be doing that, but I'm like, what I'm happy that I'm like, and grateful that I'm doing everything that like I want to be doing. Everything I'm doing are it's things that I'm super excited
intentional.
About.
Yeah,
it feels intentional finally, which is, the hustle's real.
It takes a long time to get there.
Dara documented
a
lot of that.
I was in awe of you as a musician person 10 years ago, and now I'm just blown away by the work you're doing and how beautiful and important and impactful it is simultaneously. And it's an honor to be your friend. Honor to have you here on Soul Sisters. Thank
you
so much.
Is this a wedding
toast?
For having me, right? I'm not engaged yet.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
for having me. So much love. And I'm so excited to get to know you as well.
Yeah,
and
likewise. Yeah. You're a Soul Sister now.
It's official.
Yeah.
In your head, in your head.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.